It's my great pleasure to welcome for the first time to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Martin Adams, the author of, this book right here, right beside me, Sharing the Earth, A Proposal for a Tax-Free and Prosperous World. I'm given to understand that the author and his lovely wife Saskia are new transplants to Sebastopol. We welcome them to Sebastopol generally and to Many Rivers tonight. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, everyone, for having me here. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Rob. It's a great pleasure to have Many Rivers be the first station, the very first bookstore, where I'd be giving my first book tour tonight. And before we start, though, I wanted to just take a few moments where all of us can maybe just sit and close our eyes, reflect, breathe together for just a few moments so that we can set the tune for this evening together. So I invite you to sit up straight with your eyes gently closed. Most of all, just sit comfortably. And as we just calm down, we focus on our breath. And we can feel the breath draw into the body and leave the body. One big cycle. Breathing in, breathing out. Thoughts come and go. Meanwhile, the breath keeps coming in and going out. As you feel your thoughts come in, come out, like the breath, simply observe. And slowly but surely take one more deep breath, deep inhalation, and then an equally deep, full exhalation. Slowly, surely, gently open their eyes. But as we open the eyes, we remember the feeling that we've had inside, so that when we interact and listen, we listen from this inner silence. So thank you for being here tonight once again. The reason I chose to start with a brief meditation is because the book I'm talking about today and the book that I would like you to talk to me about in terms of questions and answers, the book is at its heart a book about consciousness. However, I do talk about economics in the book. But at its heart, this book is about the question, how can we create a better world? A world that works for everyone. A world where everyone has enough. And at its heart, that is, I believe, a spiritual question. When you look around, you know, here in this bookstore, you see so much wealth. There is so much abundance. I mean, think of what it took to create this material from the earth, the production that went into every single object that you see in this bookstore. Humanity has an enormous amount of wealth at hand. Downtown, San Francisco, you see skyscrapers just going far up into the sky. And that wealth that we have created is unsurpassed, I would say unsurpassed in our entire history. And yet, why is it that with all this wealth, we still have poverty? Poverty, where people cannot feed themselves, not just in Africa, right here in America. With all this wealth, why is it that people still struggle financially? Why? When we have more than enough wealth as a society to where everyone could have a very comfortable lifestyle, a very abundant lifestyle. These questions are very difficult questions for us to ask, but we must ask them. And at heart, those are spiritual questions. Why spiritual? To me, anything is spiritual if it considers the well-being of the whole, right? When we talk about serving a higher purpose, we talk about serving something that's in the good of the whole. We talk about devoting ourselves to the well-being of other people. Tonight, I'm going to divide this talk into three sections, and we can have question and answer sessions after each of those three sections. The first section is already going on, which is I will give a brief introduction about the book, what it's about. The second section, I will talk about three core elements of the book. And the last section, I will talk about a solution. So let me briefly share with you what this book is about. As I've already insinuated, it is about creating a better world and how we can go about and do that. Now, I talk about economics in the book. Some of you may be familiar, especially you working here in the bookstore, Alfred Knopf. Yeah, he's a great publisher. He actually once said that economists have I'm paraphrasing here, they have a talent of making the comprehensible incomprehensible. Right? Now, one of my jobs, I'm not an economist, not a trained economist. Economists, or my job was it to decipher what the economists say and to translate that into a language that most of us can understand. And that's essentially what I try to do with Sharing the Earth. So in the book, I talk about economics. But I talk about economics in such a way that hopefully most of us can understand. Because economics is the basis of society, of social well-being. Economics is what determines where the money flows in our society and why it flows to certain places. So the more we can unravel this economic mystery, and the simpler we can realize what's actually happening, the more easier we'll be able to understand what it actually is that we need to do in order to create a better world. So let me give you a very brief explanation about economics. There are essentially only two ways we can create an income. Two ways we can make money. The first way, and by the way, most of us do both. There's no blaming or judging of anyone because we all do it. We all do those two things. The first way we can make an income is by contributing to society. So when you have a bookstore, you know, you provide a valued service, you provide goods, people buy, and you guys make money. But you guys make money from contributing something that is of value. Sebastopol is a richer place because this bookstore exists. Right. Now, the other way we can make an income is by extracting an income from society without contributing anything to society. Right. And that happens quite a lot, more than we realize, and we all are doing it. And where we as a society have lost our way is that we've mixed those two together. And then after we've mixed those two together, we then have to extract some of it back to society, back to the government, so that we can pay for roads, school, healthcare, and so forth. Now let me give you an example. How do we extract from society? The way I talk about it in Sharing the Earth is quite simple. When you provide a valuable good or service, you know, you're providing something to a society that you may have created. You may have created it yourself, or someone else has created it. But if, say, I owned a piece of land somewhere outside of the city, and I gave it to you for maybe, say, $1,000 a month, I rented that piece of land out to you, and you could have it for $1,000 a month. I didn't really create anything, did I? I didn't add anything to society, anything new, because that piece of land existed before I ever lived, before I was ever born. No human being created this particular piece of land, right? So now, I'm making $1,000 a month. Someone else has to pay me for using that land, $1,000 a month, right? But meanwhile, the person that's using the land, he may want to create something with his time and with his effort and his money. He may create valuable goods and services, but he still has to pay me for something that neither he nor I ever created or contributed to society. So this is where we as a society have lost our way, in a sense. I just want to take a brief pause here. Do you guys understand this very core distinction between making money from contributing to society and making money, or extracting money from society without contributing anything to society? Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Now, what I talk about in the book, Sharing the Earth, is land. You see, land is so important. We're standing on it right now. It's strange to think of it this way. We usually don't really think of we're standing on land unless we're out in nature with our feet in the earth, right? But this is concrete, but it's still land. And land is valuable in society. In fact, land is very valuable. It is so valuable that it defines almost every aspect of our economy. Why is it that land in downtown San Francisco is so expensive, when land in Santa Rosa is not that expensive? Not as expensive as in San Francisco. Does anyone have an idea why that might be?
It's because other people have built around it. Things that, so you don't have to go, for instance, you don't have to go so far, or you can go the same distance and encounter many other things.
Exactly. That's it. And that's, you just nailed it on the head. It's other people. So other people have made your land more valuable. If you own a piece of land in the desert, you know, far from humanity, it's worth nothing. Nothing. Even if you build a skyscraper on that piece of land, put millions of dollars into that land, build a huge skyscraper, well, the land wouldn't be worth anything above and beyond the value of the building. Right. But the land underneath the building is still worth nothing. Land only attains its value from the services and the goods that exist in the surrounding environment. So here's the kicker. If human beings profit from land, what do they profit from?
The work of others.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. You just said it. When we profit from land, we profit from other people's efforts, from other people's contributions to society. Now you can see it's endemic, right? Everyone does it. We all do it. We all profit from land. We all have, you know, we own real estate, we sell it for profit or for loss and back and forth. Everyone, you know, people want to be on the property ladder, and banks profit from it, mortgages profit from it. It's endemic. And our entire society is participating in this game of extraction, extracting wealth from humanity, from society, from other people. And in a sense, what this is, it's like a big what do you call these, game of musical chairs, right? You will always have some losers, by the way, and this is why we have poverty. If you have this, you know, you have nine people, but six chairs. And then when the music stops, three people would be left standing. And those usually are the people that we see on the streets, people that cannot afford to buy, and people that have to pay other human beings to live in a certain location. So this is a very brief introduction about sharing the earth. In the next part, I will go into three different areas, how this game of extraction affects us, all of us. And it doesn't benefit really anyone, not even the wealthy, because as long as we live in a society where other people are struggling financially, even the wealthy, even the well-to-do, are worse off. They have to fend for themselves, they have to install security cameras, they have to install burglar alarms and so forth. I mean, those are just some examples. So, in the third part, I would present a solution, what we can do to create a more just society. But for now, before we move into the second and then later the third part, do you guys have any questions about what we just shared?
Well, I think I feel you've left out interest. That's not land.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very common.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be ridiculous. But just because I have money,
mm-hmm.
And it's easy to give it to somebody else,
mm-hmm.
that I should get more for it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's an accepted way of increasing your wealth, and that's happening enormously. And it used to be illegal. Not it used to be Christianity. Christians didn't believe in it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the Muslims are still actively opposed to it, I believe.
Yeah.
But I discovered today people, lots of young people don't know what usury is.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be, when I was young, I asked what it was, and I was told it was 10%. Anything above 10% was unreasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's not hard to find 30%
right.
interest
yeah.
extracted.
Yeah.
And why people don't, they go along with this thing that nothing is produced by that person is giving money to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only thing I would have said. You picked land. I don't quarrel with land as very essential, but I see more frequently that interest
mm-hmm.
is the way.
The money question is another big topic, and the money question is talked about a lot more these days. You hear a lot more talk about the Federal Reserve and how they issue money as debt and so forth. And that's personally not my area of expertise at the moment. I focus on land, because if I had to write about money as well, this would be twice as thick, if not three times as thick. So I just had to focus on money, on land. And both, I agree, both are very, very important questions. And really what it comes down to, and what you're saying, is monopoly. Monopolies are certain forms, certain structures by which we can extract wealth from other people without having to work or contribute from it. But I'm digressing at this point. So just want to say thank you for that, and you know, that's not something that I can talk about at this point. But I agree, it needs to be talked about. Any other questions or comments?
There's a comment in here somewhere.
Mm.
And it has to do with community and with relationship being real wealth.
Yeah.
It has to do with how many people are involved in your survival system.
Yeah.
And the more people who are, when someone else is involved in your survival system, you feel a little more secure.
Mm-hmm.
Security is related to our relationship with money,
mm-hmm.
and how we go with it. stuck in the middle of our own survival struggle, it affects how we relate with everything. I think that's all for now.
Thank you, Michael.
Yes.
So.
And money becomes more valuable. As when relationships become more valuable, then money means less and less. And when relationships diminish in value, then money becomes more and more important.
Yeah, for many people.
Yes.
Yeah.
You made an analogy to musical chairs, where there's a scarcity of chairs, but I didn't get what produces a scarcity in this prosperous society.
Yeah. In our current society, land is scarce. And I hear you say, what do you mean land is scarce? You just walk out, you know, drive out 5 minutes out of town and there's plenty of land. But if you look at it, it's all owned, fenced off. Land is naturally scarce because you can't make more of it. You can't make more of it in certain locations. Was it the comedian Will Rogers, right? He said, I don't remember this anymore, so I better not share this. But anyway, he made this offhand remark about land. I should buy land because they... Oh, this is it. Buy land because they don't make any more of it, right? And so essentially, land is scarce. You can't make it. It's limited. It's a, you know, talk about supply and demand. Well, actually, the supply part, you can expand the supply. The only time that we can expand supply is if we explore frontiers where no human being lives, but you know the earth is already pretty much explored. Plus, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to settle in Alaska when all the wealth that we want is right here in this town. So, does that answer your question?
Well, it brings up more because I see that the history of California is making agricultural land by the redirection of water. So, in some sense, then that's creating more productive land.
When you create more productive land, it increases the desirability for that land, doesn't it? Right. So therefore, it increases its value. Right. And so, when you increase that value of the land, yeah, it becomes more valuable. So what is your...
Well, you were saying about the cost of land in the desert would be almost nothing. So, yeah, they're not making any more of it, but there's still a lot of it that you can have for nothing.
That's true, but then you have to add your labor to it.
Right.
And even when you add your labor to it, in itself it won't be worth anything if it's not complemented by surrounding population. Right, so if you... You know, you take land in the desert, you make it very productive, but it's in the desert and it takes you 100 miles to get to it and then to grow your food and then ship it out, you know, 100 miles, then it's still going to be worth almost nothing. So, you know, land value is a reflection not just of what you do with it, it's actually, the value of land is not a reflection of what you do with it, the raw value. The raw value, not the improvements to the land, but the raw value, it's just a reflection of all the wealth that exists in its surrounding environment. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah? Okay. Let's move on to the second part. Check the time. Good. I would talk very briefly about two things I mentioned in the book. One is the environment, and the other is economic recessions and business recessions. Now, the economists among us, they know this stuff. They know what I'm talking about. But a lot of them aren't given a voice. You know, they may not have the skills to write a book that is appealing to the average reader. They may not have the interest or the time to do that. So it is up to us to share this wisdom and this knowledge, this wisdom that all these economists have passed on to us. And this wisdom expresses itself in two ways that I want to talk about specifically. One is the environment, we talk a lot about sustainability, right? We want to be sustainable, right? Well, what is sustainability? Sustainability means that we don't have to borrow from our future generations. In other words, we can continue our way of life theoretically indefinitely, and we don't have to sacrifice the quality of life of our future generations. Now, right now, this is an interesting fact. Humanity has used about 45% of all the land that's on this planet. 45% intensively, like 45% of all the earth. And by 2020, we should cross the 50% mark. So half of this planet will be intensively used by human beings. And if you look at the graph, I'm not going to show it. Oh, let me show it to you now briefly. It's a hockey stick. Do you know what a hockey stick looks like? It, you know, goes like this and then goes up very quickly. This is how our land use is progressing. As we become more populated, as we realize the benefits of owning land and profiting from land, we seek to hoard more and more land. And the rainforest in the Amazon is affected by it. I will tell more about that in a few minutes. Here, let me just show you this. So right now, it's actually 43%. We're using 43%. In 1700, we used 4%. 100 years later, 6%, 10%, and then 50 years later, only 15%. It goes more and quicker and quicker and quicker. Essentially, what I'm saying is that we are using too much land. We don't need to use this much land. Not for agriculture, not for human living. A lot of the land that you see out there when you drive is just fenced off. It's not being used. And yet, you know, those barbed wires prevent wildlife, nature, from just thriving. And if we human beings were to just use as much land as we truly need it, we actually would have a world where human beings would cluster together into very various towns and cities, and then and then on the outer rims you'd have agriculture, and then between those clusters there would be pure nature, without fences, without human, human involvement. And that's the kind of world that is in balance. Currently, our imbalanced world is human beings are just sprawled. They're everywhere. When you drive from one city to another, you may not notice yet that you're actually driving from one city to another, because all you see is towns and buildings everywhere. So, how do we use less land? How can we do that?
We need a new model.
A new model, yeah.
Would you say we need a new model?
Yeah.
Well, it's suggested by Henry George that the government taxed the land mm-hmm. at a higher rate. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you couldn't then have fields, plots of land people buy because they realize the value of land is going to go up as the population goes up at least, or maybe faster. But if they were taxed on it, they would have to shrink back away from that tax expense
mm-hmm.
and just use the little land that they have more effectively.
And that's exactly what I would talk about. And that Henry George and other economists before and since him have suggested that we do that. So before, let me quickly touch upon another topic that's also important. It's related, but people don't see how they're connected. If I talk about the environment, that's all good, we can understand. And then if I talk about the economy and the recessions and the booms and busts that we have, that's another topic entirely, isn't it? Right? Two different topics. People don't see how they're related, but they are. They're connected. So you have the economy, you have booms and busts. Welcome. Hey. 2008 was 5 years ago. So 5 years ago, we had a huge economic recession. We call this the Great Recession. It's still lingering. Why did it happen? If you listen to the media would tell you that because of this mysterious contraction, you know, mortgage lending, speculation, all this stuff, because we had this economic contraction, the real estate market collapsed because of this economic contraction. But actually, it's the other way around. Because we speculated in real estate, that brought about the economic collapse. It's not that the real estate market depends upon the health of the economy. The health of the economy depends upon the health of the real estate market. And if you speculate too much in real estate, it creates a bubble, and that bubble eventually bursts, and that burst causes a contraction in the economy. So the real estate bubble is related to land again, right? Because when a property becomes more valuable, you buy a property for say $400,000, and then 5 years later you can sell it for $600,000. Well, it's not that the house became more valuable, you know. Your house, if anything, became less valuable, unless you made some grand improvements to it. Over time, the building deteriorates. Well, what became more valuable then?
After the expectation of you making more money. That was what went up. The expectations that you could make more money. So people then paid more money for the house.
Yeah, but what did they pay for? Did they pay for the actual building, or did they pay for? For what?
The opportunity to make money.
Location, or I heard some people say location, exactly. The land. You see, I hear you, you're right. But you make money, why? Because when you're a homeowner, you have a monopoly on the location. You have a monopoly on the land upon which your house is located. Right? So real estate consists of two things. One is land. The other is a building, two things. The building, if anything, becomes less valuable over time. But the location, the land that's underneath the building, becomes more valuable the more people move to your area, the more prosperous the surrounding environment becomes. So when you have speculation in land, in real estate, what actually happens is that the land that's underneath the house becomes more and more and more valuable, to the point that human beings won't be able to afford that land anymore. They won't be able to afford living there anymore. And guess what? When they cannot afford to live there anymore, they have to cut back on their expenses. They have to cut back on their expenses even though they don't want to. They still want to buy certain things, but they can't. They now have to spend less. And that contraction in spending causes, amongst other factors, a recession. And then when you have this contraction in spending, you can't produce more, even though people want to produce more because they want to work more so that they can afford to spend. I may go a bit more into this theory now, but do you get the general idea that if it costs too much to live in a certain location, you're forced to spend less, and when you're forced to spend less, people don't buy anymore as many goods. And when people don't buy anymore as many goods, you can't produce anymore as many goods as you want so that you can afford to buy more things. And then it becomes like it's a downward spiral. And that's essentially what happened. So both the environment and the economy, the health of the economy and the health of the environment, they're connected. And they're connected with land. I often say it all comes down to land. the ground upon which we walk. Does anyone have any questions or comments about that?
Well, I would say, your theory, they're saying, okay, as we've seen with Sebastopol, the home values, land, is very desirable, and it's going up in price. So what happens is in Southern California, like, hardly anyone can afford to live in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
They move out to the valley.
Right.
And so these desirable areas, the desirability, so not everybody can be, unless we want to build skyscrapers, in the location that they want to be in.
Mm-hmm.
So their other option is to move to Katani or a park, to use a local example.
Yeah.
So how does that fit into it?
It's called gentrification, right? You have poor neighborhoods that over time become more and more valuable, and then what happens is, as it becomes more and more valuable, those people that used to live in those neighborhoods are then forced out onto the margins. The economists call that the margin. So I see your face.
Well,
tell me more.
I mean, they're forced out because they're forced to sell their property to somebody that's going to develop it more intensely.
Yeah.
And so they, in their being forced, they walk away with a pocket full of money.
Oh, in that way.
So,
I meant more renters, like people that rent. They don't make money from land. Yeah.
But if it's the person who owned the property.
Yeah. Yeah, and it comes back down to that. I want to make sure I understand your question.
Well, the point was that, you're acting like, okay, that everybody is in Sebastopol, just for this example, and their only choice is to spend more money on their housing. That's the only choice, and then they don't have money to buy more books and whatever, t-shirts. So
teapots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't need to go there. But anyway, so they have other choices.
Okay, so you mean in terms of what it causes, economic recessions, what I just explained, that cycle, is that what you mean?
I'm saying that there's other options other than just spending more on housing so that they can't
I see what
buy
you mean.
More goods and services.
Yeah. Well, what about someone that, say has a store here, and just it's very easy to say, I'm just going to move to Katari, but meanwhile in Katari the real estate has gone up as well. You see, this monopoly is in place everywhere. When you have an economic recession comes about because real estate, the price of a location rises, not only goes up to the point where it becomes unaffordable, at which point you say they can then move out, right? And so therefore this can prevent, is that what you're saying, that this can...
No, I mean this is a constant thing that's happening all since the beginning of time. Desirability 20 years ago, people were fleeing San Francisco and moving out to the suburbs because they felt life was better now there.
Yeah.
And now San Francisco's back in, and the skyscrapers are going up, and people want to live in the city. So there's always this continual change.
But in all the situations that you describe, the people that own the properties are the winners, aren't they? So as San Francisco becomes more valuable, the homeowners cash out. If they move to Katari or other places, the homeowners over there can cash out. And by this process, those that own the homes, that own land, make money without actually having added anything new, without having added anything of value. And the more people do that in a closed economy, the less money you have to pay for wages and production costs, within that closed system. Does that make sense?
What do you mean by a closed system?
So
I know what a closed system is, but you maintain that every town is a closed system?
It's everything is permeable, but yet everything is also they're like rooms in a house, right? The air you breathe in one room is the same kind of air that's in the other rooms, but they're all connected. Let me say this: the U.S. economy affects other economies in our global economy, right? And yet, it doesn't matter. It doesn't mean that what happens in the U.S. economy doesn't matter, because it does affect other countries. In the same way, if you have a real estate bubble in San Francisco, it does spread out to other towns. Vice versa, if you have a real estate bubble in San Francisco, this example isn't working too well. I just wanted to clarify what your question. If you have a closed system in San Francisco, I'm using closed not because it's actually closed, but because it's condensed. Maybe that's a better way of describing it, right? So if you can have a real estate bubble in San Francisco, and when you have a real estate bubble, more and more people are profiting from land. Land becomes more valuable, and that leaves less financial resources for the population that makes money by contributing to society. In other words, when more and more money in a relatively closed economy or in a certain location, when more and more money is paid on real estate, it will create a scarcity for labor to obtain money through their wages.
So what I think you're saying is, as renters, people that are renting, and as the demand increases, prices go up on the rentals, and then those people, assuming their wages stay constant, then they do not have as much money to spend on goods and services.
Exactly.
That's what you're trying to say.
Yeah, and not only that, yes, exactly, that the wages, they stay constant. Meanwhile, the cost of living increases. And you don't have that cost of living reflected in the CPI, in the Consumer Price Index. You know, but yet it's so fundamental. The price of land is so fundamental to our existence. Does that answer all your questions,
yeah,
or do you have some more?
No, no. I just, yeah, your model works.
It even works let's say everyone in this room owned property. It even works with this. If all of us own land, some of us own more land than others. Some of us own land in more desirable locations than others. You see, when some people profit from land value increases, others lose out. Because you can't have everyone own the best land in town. It's not going to happen. So what I'm saying is that, really, the essence of what I'm saying is that no human being should be able to profit from land. And yet all of us should be able to profit from our contributions to society. Does that make sense? So if any other comments or questions, otherwise I'm going to move on to the next. And last. So, at the very end, this last section, I want to talk a bit about this solution.
That's what I want to hear about.
Yes. And this solution has been proposed by many economists throughout time. Many economists, especially one guy, you mentioned him before, there was a guy called Henry George. He lived about 130 years ago, 150 years ago. Today, nobody's heard of him. His reputation has been lost and forgotten throughout time. He was a person who was one of the most prominent economists and philosophers to advocate the solution. But there have been others before him, and there have been others since him. And essentially, the solution is this. charge people for the land that they use instead of tax them, instead of taxing them. So today we have a situation where we have income taxes, sales taxes, capital gains taxes, you know, you name it. And those taxes consume a huge majority of our time, of our money, of our energy. I mean, gosh, if I think of how many hours I spend every year filing my taxes, I just get sick. I'm sorry. Right? You may have some similar experiences. What we can do instead of having to pay our taxes, it is possible for us to have a revenue stream that goes towards our society, towards our government, whether it's a county government, the state government, or the federal government, which is if we simply stop paying our taxes and started paying for the land and the natural resources that we extract and use, then government can be fully funded. And it's not a tax, this charge. And the reason it's not a tax is because a tax is something that is ours, right? So income tax is a tax on your income, right? If you pay income tax, it's a tax on what is yours, which is your income. Sales tax is a tax on your sales. But what I'm talking about is a land value fee or a land fee. Some people have called it a land value tax. I don't think it's a tax so much because the value of land, as we've determined in the very beginning of our talk, the value of land exists only because of all the people that live in the surrounding environment. So in other words, when you own land, when you own property, your right is to the value of the building that you own, but not the land. The land value is actually a community product. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, isn't it? I often make that distinction. It's okay for you to, you know, claim land as your own. Say, this is my land. I bought it. It's mine. But there's a value that's attached to that land. And that value is actually a community product. It belongs to the community because the community has created it. Makes sense, right? Please,
how is
Alan.
This different from property taxes?
Yeah, good question. Property taxes are a tax on the entire property, on the value of the building, plus the value of the improvements that you've done to the land, plus the actual land itself. Whereas this is just a tax or a fee or a charge on the location value, you know, on the land
value,
the raw
value,
land. The raw land. Not the improvements to it. So if you made the land look more beautiful, that doesn't factor into it. It's just the location value.
How is the location value determined?
Good question. So these days we have computers that help us with it. We do. And the one thing about location values, they don't depend upon building inspectors. You know, for property taxes, you have to have someone come out to your property, inspect it, you know, give a rough estimation of how much the building is worth, how much the land is worth, and so forth. And it takes a lot of effort. But location values are really determined through several factors. You can plug into a computer program, for example, commercial leasing values. You put those factors into the computer program. You put when land is sold, empty land that has no improvements to it, when that is sold, you can estimate the rental value of land as well from that. And you put that into the computer program as well. And then you can average the land values. They are usually quite similar from one neighboring plot to another. For example, here we are right on Main Street. The building next door, it might be, I don't know, is it a larger building, smaller?
It's a two-story building.
Two-story, and this is one story?
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Two-story, yeah.
Okay, well, let's just say if the building next door were a three-story, four-story building, the property value of this would be lower than the property value of the building next to it. but the location value would actually be the same, or almost the same, because we're both on Main Street, and both have a great walking distance to the heart. We're really in the heart of downtown. So you can put in all these variables into a computer program, and that computer program can then average it out and determine the location value for each piece of land. Any other questions or comments?
So what about extracting resources? Whether you're intensively farming the land, you're making it better, or you're making it worse, or you're harvesting the timber, or you're building up the minerals.
Yeah. The state of state in Canada, are those states? Provinces, right. The province of British Columbia, it actually says that the timber of British Columbia belongs to the people of British Columbia. It's a beautiful thing to say. And what that actually means is that the value of nature belongs to every human being equally. When you have timber companies, for example, when they go and log trees, that value is you want to share that value of the natural resource value with society, and you do this by leasing out the land at a competitive market rate. So if you have, say, five different timber companies wanting to log a certain area, that market rate, how much this piece of land with the trees can be rented for, that's the value, the innate value of the natural resource. Does that make sense? Right? So if you have a land, you know, say it's worth $100,000 a year for its timber every year, right? And that's how much timber companies would have to pay.
I don't quite understand that. My property, I have tree stumps out there, 9 feet in diameter.
Mm.
So they were here in this area, and those were cut down and sold. And so it's the price of that land should have been enormous in order to return to the people living in this region something that they didn't create, except for what the trees grew during the, we might say, they participated in that time. It's not the location of that land.
No.
Where I'm confused there.
Yeah.
It seems to me that should have been taxed so as to, when they sell that tree, that ancient tree, the money went to the government or something, the people,
yeah,
rather than going to the people who bought the land and stripped the trees off it.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. So the people that cut the trees, they might have bought it from the previous owner who pocketed that money. They logged the trees and sold the trees on the open market, right? So the timber companies didn't return that natural resource value that they extracted. They didn't return that back to the community.
No.
They just paid it to the previous owner of the land.
No, they didn't do that. They just as soon as they cut the tree down, they sold it.
Yeah, and then they essentially extracted that natural resource value.
But it didn't go to the previous owner, though.
Didn't they buy the land from the previous owner?
It went to the people who cut. They had the right to cut it down. They went ahead and cut it down.
Okay.
And
who gave them that right?
The agreements of the society.
But the society gave them that right, but they didn't pay society a market rate for that right, did they? Usually not.
No,
yeah.
They didn't. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's why they profited from nature at society's expense.
Yeah.
When you talk about a market rate,
yeah,
you're talking about today, but that's being stolen from the next 10 generations.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have to count that into your market rate. get representatives for, you know, the next 500 years and have
yeah.
them.
Yeah, especially if it's non-renewable.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, Adam. I wish I did. Let me research that, and maybe I can get back to you. That's a really good question.
A similar thing. I think it will be difficult to make those assessments, but very important to try. It would only be better than what's done now.
Yeah.
I'm acquainted with the consequences of the same logging that you're referring to. The logging roads are eroding into the creek, and we've had the whole Russian River salmon system crash in population for a variety of reasons, but that's one of them. And now there's fish and game funding to restore the integrity of the land so that it doesn't erode on those old logging roads.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of money being put into that. Again, that is coming from society to repair the damage done by those who extracted.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's unfortunate, isn't it? There was an economist, Mason Gaffney, who lives in Southern California. I almost included this in the book. He did a back of the envelope calculation on what the current timber practices are in Northern California. And I think if I remember correctly, he said that timber companies pay to the state of California, but I think it's 1% of the natural resource value. 1% instead of 100%. 1%. So they profit immensely. Meanwhile, the state of California is broke. Any other questions?
I got solutions. Let's see.
Yeah,
I'm all ears.
How do we get from here to there?
Yes. So,
Michael. I want to give maybe some new attention to the word value. Question: What is important to you? What is valuable to you?
Yeah.
And I think that we need to see a shift in value towards the ethic that underlies the nature of our inhabiting the land. And when the ethic becomes more valuable to us than the physical resources, then humans become more accessible to each other for creating community.
Yeah.
And in community, ultimately community is the solution.
Yeah.
And so the question is, what makes humans more accessible to each other for doing that?
Yeah, that's a great.
Because humans right now, they're a mixed bag.
Yeah,
they're not easy to live with. So when we become more easier to live with, we'll see things shifting. I think I
couldn't have said it any better. Thank you for saying that. That to me, that is the solution. The heart, the very heart of what we need to do, is really much more than an economic solution. Sure, I could tell you that on an economic level, we need to stop taxing wages, capital gains, and sales taxes, and so forth. Stop those taxes, and start charging people for the land that they use. And that's the economic solution. Start charging people a competitive market rate for the land that they use, land and other natural resources. But at its heart, it's really what you're saying, Michael, which is that we have to, in order for us to do that, we have to be in a state where we care for each other, where we respect each other, and where we recognize that if we profit from land, we hurt each other. And when we hurt each other, we hurt ourselves. I mean, that's really the core of the message.
I heard a great definition of economics once. It's simply how people take care of each other.
Yeah. Exactly. And we're not doing a very good job at it right now. I was just in San Francisco the other day, and you know, I was in SoMa, and you have these skyscrapers, and among these skyscrapers, you have beggars. And I just asked myself, why do we have so many people struggling for money? You know, when we have so much, we're not taking care of each other. And I think we need to first observe that we're not, instead of just attributing that to, oh yeah, he's crazy, or yeah, he's poor, he should get a job. You know, I mean, that's usually what we're thinking on some level, but we have to wake up and learn that we're all in this together, and it's all of us that have to create this new paradigm together. So I just want to be mindful of the time. I think
the
solution, I said very briefly, we need a new economic model. No more taxes on incomes, no more taxes on sales, capital gains, no, most other taxes, no more. And instead, charge homeowners, property owners, and anyone that uses land, timber companies, oil companies, and so forth, charge them for the land and for the natural resources that they use. And when we do that, we can create a better world.
Does your book describe how to get there from where we are?
It does. There are three steps. Because this is a massive undertaking, and truly, I'm under no illusions that this is something that we can achieve in 10 years, because the resistance is huge. I mean, talk about timber companies or entrenched corporations. Because this is such a huge undertaking, this may take several hundred years, possibly. But it doesn't have to. The first step, those three steps in the very end I talk about, the first step really is awareness. It's what we're doing right now. We're becoming aware. We're becoming more conscious. Oh, okay. If I do that, then this leads to this, and this leads to this, and this leads to this. So the more people are aware, the more of a chance we stand to change. Right? So the second step is education. Once we've become more aware, we start educating our friends, our family members, we talk more. Until then, it becomes a political discourse, a social discourse. Right now, you don't hear this on CNN or the news, because no one's talking about it. But I want us to get to a place where in 10 years, maybe in 50 years, we start talking about it. We start talking about it in our communities, we start talking about it in the news, we start talking about it maybe even on Capitol Hill. Maybe. And once we start talking about it, that's when we have a chance to implement it on a legislative level. And that's, in my view, the process that we have to do in order to get there. Yeah. Any other questions, comments?
You said the other one is to stop paying taxes and start paying fees for use of the commons.
Yeah.
So I've started with the first half.
Great. Congratulations. Good. Anything else? Now, I still pay my taxes, just so you know. I'm not someone who advocates tax evasion, I guess, because that can just land you in prison, and then you're no good. You can't talk to other people about it. So that's just my approach. I said, you know, follow the law. Do, you know, mind my own little business, and then spread the message.
How would this work? This paying for the land that you use. Who collects this money?
The county.
How is it distributed to society?
It starts on a local level. It's the counties that collect the money, and then they pass it on to the state level, and then also up to the federal level. Right now, a lot of what we're doing is we're taking money from the local level, extracting it, paying it to the federal level, which is bloated, and then it kind of trickles down to the state, and it kind of trickles down back to the community. And under this new system, we truly would empower local communities, because the money is collected on the local level, and then from the local level passed up to the state and then to the federal level. I think I want to close now if there are no other questions, comments. Thank you so much for being here tonight, and Rob is going to close with some more announcements. And you can also see the book, follow me on my website, which is sharingtheearth.com, just like the book title. And you can read the book online, you can take the physical copy home with you, and just I would love it if you kept in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.